Welcome to Occult of Personality at occultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
This is a Cult of Personality podcast, episode number 119, featuring an interview with Taylor Elwood about his book, Magical Identity, an exploration of space, time, neuroscience, and identity. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thank you for listening. Support for a Cult of Personality podcast comes from the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section, as well as all those generous listeners who click the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website to sponsor this episode. Thanks again to Steve in the UK, Michal in Slovakia, Trina, Neil, Adela, and Shadowlit Productions. I want to take a moment to mention the upcoming 2012 Esoteric Book Conference taking place in Seattle, Washington, on September 15th and 16th. Tickets are now available at their website at esotericbookconference.com. I'm honored to be the moderator for the discussion panel entitled Eastern Thought in the Western Occult World, featuring Craig Williams, Salvatore Zambito, and Gordon Jurjevic. I look forward to seeing you there. Now, in podcast episode number 119, Taylor Elwood returns to the show. He previously appeared in a Cult of Personality podcast episode number 33. You can find Taylor online at magicalexperiments.com. Taylor Elwood is a mage whose eclectic background includes the study and practice of Hermeticism, Neo-Shamanism, Chaos Magic, Tantra, Taoism, Buddhism, Bon, as well as his own systems of magic. Taylor is also the author of a number of cutting-edge books on the occult, and he is the managing nonfiction editor of Amanian Press. In this interview, he talks primarily about his recent book, Magical Identity, an exploration of space, time, neuroscience, and identity. Taylor's work is known as original and creative, forging a new path and pushing the limits of perceived success. Taylor Elwood, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been about 4 years, so it's been quite a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while. So I guess that's a good place to start, because there may be people listening who aren't familiar with you and your work, and maybe you could just give us a little bit of your background and talk about some of your influences and your previous books that you've published.
Sure. Well, I first started writing back in, let's see, it would probably be 2002, professionally, and had my first book, co-written book, Creating Magical Entities, published then. I've been practicing magic since I was 16, which is back in the 1990s, so. And then in 2004, I published Pop Culture Magic, and 2005, Space-Time Magic, Inner Alchemy in 2006, and then Multimedia Magic at the very beginning of 2008. I've also done a couple of anthologies, such as the Pop Culture Grimoire, Magic on the Edge, and Manifesting Prosperity. And then I took about a five-year break from writing books on the occult, and my latest actually came out in March of this year. And the reason I took the five-year break was because I was actually doing a lot of research for that book, and I basically spent about 3 years just reading and experimenting and doing research, and then the next 2 years writing and continuing to do experimentation. And it was a very involved process, so it wasn't one of those things you could just, you know, whip out in a year, you know, and so I always say it's better to focus on the quality than trying to go for the quantity, and I think that's really important.
No doubt, you know, I agree with you. So now your latest book is Magical Identity, an exploration of space, time, neuroscience, and identity. It's published by Amanian Press, is that correct?
Correct, it is, yes.
Yeah.
Before we get into talking specifically about the book, could you just tell us a little bit about your intention behind the book?
Well, you know, when I had finished up Multimedia Magic, you know, I looked back at Inner Alchemy and Space-Time Magic, and I thought, you know, there's more work to be done there than what I had already done, and I, you know, kind of kept up on it, and so part of the intention was to continue discussing the experimentation that it had that I'd written about in both of those books. But a lot of it really came down to the fact that I started to look at magic from a different angle than I had before, from an ontological angle, or an angle of identity, being, as opposed to an angle of doing. And that, you know, some of that kind of shows up in Multimedia Magic, where I talk a bit about identity and, you know, and definitions of magic and things along those lines. But it was one of those things where I really began to look at that, and I asked myself, well, two questions. One was, well, what is identity, and what does that mean? And, you know, how do we really define identity? What does identity really look like? And then the next question was, where does identity even fit into magic? You know? And it was interesting because as I kept looking at different books, I didn't really see this concept of identity addressed in any of the books and out there on magic. I mean, there wasn't really many authors who talked about it. So I thought that was interesting in and of itself. And or rather, when they did talk about it, I would see things like, oh, we got to kill the ego, or, you know, get away from identity, yada, 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 you know, like what Robert Anton Wilson would talk about, or Timothy Leary, or some of these other various authors. And I thought, well, I don't want to necessarily kill my ego or identity. I want to have a healthy relationship with it. So that was what really informed the intention of the book. And as I started doing research, I naturally continued to do research on the magical side of things. But I also ended up bringing in a lot of elements of neuroscience but then also studies of anthropological studies of space and time and some other things along those lines. And this just increased my interest more, because what it really showed me was these really fascinating examinations of identity in terms of not just a sense of self, but really how it applies to how people situate themselves in the world around them, and the agreements that they form within themselves and with the world as well, as to what kind of experiences they're going to have in life. And so that's really the intention of that book, is to explore all that and offer some exercises, experiments, and possibilities for people reading the book so that they can expand their horizons and see what will happen with them as a result.
One of the things that I'm curious about is this concept of identity that you identified and that you're exploring in your work here. Do you find that that is a relatively recent development in sort of the history of humanity? I've been taught that in the past, even as recently as the Middle Ages, the concept of like individuality or personal identity was something that was like very foreign to people who were at least not educated. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I think that the concept of identity from a historical perspective really hasn't been around that long. You know, I think it's something that has arisen more recently, you know, as a result of psychology, result of ontological studies and things along those lines. Or maybe it's there, or maybe it's better to say it's there, but it's been around, but the way it's shown up hasn't been as overt and obvious as it is now. And I want to make a point, though, that it's not really the same as individuality, and I think that that's, you know, a different thing in and of itself. I think it's... And I guess what I would really say is that – let me clarify this again. I guess what I would really say is that the concept of identity has been around, but how it's shown up has been different, because when we look at the concept of identity and how it shows up, there's this very distinct and different cultural aspects to it. So, you know, when you look at a society and a culture that was, you know, around 500 years ago, there's definitely a sense of identity there. a sense of where people fit into the grand scheme of that society and that culture and everything else. Now, whether they had a sense of individuality in the way that we do, that in and of itself would be a little bit different. And I think that that's really kind of the key, is that when we look at this concept of identity from a historical perspective, it's always been there, but the way that it's shown up and the way that we understand it is not necessarily been the same thing as what was available before.
Ah, thank you for clarifying that. Could you talk a little bit more about these different models for understanding magic? It seems like as human beings, we need some sort of framework in which to try to conceptualize that which might be beyond our five senses. And psychology seems like one way to try to do that. But you're also looking at a different model. So I'm just curious if you can like talk a little bit about the models some more, and maybe there's others that are out there that I haven't mentioned.
Well, you know, there's a fair amount of talk in recent occult literature about the four models of magic: the information model, the psychological model, the spiritual model, the energetic model. I guess we could argue that that the approach from identity is an identity model. I wouldn't call it a psychological model, because while there are aspects of psychology that are relevant to it, there's a lot more going on there than just psychology. The important thing to remember is, first of all, is that a model is just that. It's a model. It's not the territory. So it's not the experience. It's a description, a concept, really, that people use to say, this is what I'm doing, and here's how it could relate to you. And I say that because I think a lot of times people get really wrapped up on this idea of the model and try and make themselves, apply it and make it into a reality, when in fact it's really just a descriptor. And not always necessarily a good one. And in fact, that models in and of themselves can sometimes really put blinders on us in terms of the experiences that we could have. When I look at this model of identity, in terms of magic, it's distinctly different from the other ones, because the other ones are all about doing. Psychological model is, it's all in your head. All these experiences that you're having, it's all in your head. And what you're doing is, when you're working with a demon, you're experiencing this part of yourself that you've demonized, and that's why it's coming up. Okay, that's what their argument is. And then you've got the energetic model, which says, well, what we're really working with is we're working with different forms of energy. Now, between you and me and everyone else out there, energy is a very, very ambiguous word. I mean, what does that word even mean? It's so overused, it's not even funny. But, they're talking, well, so are we talking about Reiki? Are we talking about something else? Are we dealing with demonic energy? What does that really mean? And then we've got the information approach, which says, well, basically, what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with information. And so the demon that you're invoking or summoning, it represents a different type of information, and it's conveying information to you. It's kind of like it's basically the computer programmer approach to magic. And then we've got the spiritual approach, which is, well, we're actually interacting with an objective entity, and it has its own needs and wants and everything else. And when we might have to threaten it, or we can try and create a relationship with it, or something else along those lines. But what we're really trying to do is we're really existing in this place where there's all these different spirits that we have to interact with. The identity approach says it's not about doing magic; it's about being magic. And the difference being that instead of trying to will something to happen, to occur, and doing your true will or whatever else, we become the magic. We become the possibility that we want to bring into our lives. I'm going to use this word because I love it. We embody it. The identity model really focuses on the recognition that the body is an essential part of your magic. and that the identity that you have on the level of your body and your culture and with your, the identity you have with the space around you and the time and everything, all those things create this sense of a person, this identity that has interaction with all these other identities out there, people, places, things, spirits, what have you. And the key is really that what we're doing with identity is we're changing that position. We're changing where we're at to somewhere else. And on a certain level, we learn to give up control and to accept that other place that we want to go to, that other state of identity. We reach into this relationship with the universe and we basically say, here's what I want. Now I'm going to allow it to fully, I'm going to embrace it and I'm going to allow it to fully take over so that I show up in this other space, this other time, as this. And I mentioned space and time because those are integral parts of this particular model. Now, is my model better than everyone else's? You know what? I'm not going to say that it is. It works for me.
Well, that's the only thing that really matters is does it work for you?
It works for me.
Yeah.
It gets results. It's something that has improved my life, and that's what really matters. I think each person really has to – that the relationship that a person has with their magical practice is ultimately a personal one.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately should be very personalized. And I'm of the opinion that the majority of magical books out there tend to be prescriptive. They try to tell you what to do and how to do it, and they say if you deviate from this, then you're not doing it right. And my approach is descriptive. It's do what works for you. You find your way to express it and communicate it. It may not be how I would do things, but that's not the point. You're not me. I'm me. So I'm going to do things the way that I think. I'm going to become what it is I want to become, and you're going to do what you need to do. And that's fine. And I think that the benefit of a descriptive approach is that it actually gives people room to experiment and explore. And as you know, that's a very big theme within my magical work, is this idea of experimentation. Because the only way we can really advance our spirituality, our magical technique, whatever you want to call it, the only way we can really advance it is to experiment, is to open ourselves up to new perspectives and angles and considerations, and to see, well, if we do it this way, how does it differ from this other way?
Mm-hmm.
What's concerned me, at least within the recent occult literature, is, you know, there's this tendency of, well, magic works, but we don't really know how it works, and we don't need to know how, but we want to share this information with other people. And it's like, well, okay, well, if you want to share information with other people, if you want to write books, you at some level have to be able to explain how what you're doing works. What's the process? How do you get to that result? You know? So you define the result, then you define the process, and you define your role within that process. And if you can't explain that, then maybe you got the result this time, but are you going to get it next time? It's basically push-button magic at that point.
If I think more about it, it probably goes more to the idea of having the framework really is more important than what it is.
Well, you have to have some kind of foundation, mm-hmm. framework. You have to be able to define what you're doing, and that's where a framework comes into play. A framework defines your process. It defines your approach to magic. It's something that provides enough of a boundary that you can say, all right, this is the actual technique that I'm going to do, and here's why I'm going to do it, and here's how it's going to interact with the world around me as well as interact with my identity.
Mm-hmm.
To produce this result. And then here's the consequences of achieving that result, and here's how I'm going to manage or handle those consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just kind of the reality. The very fact that you and I are communicating right now is an example of us trying to find a framework. The very act of communication, sharing words, defining things, explaining things, all of that is really driven around this idea that in order to understand each other, we have to, on some level, come up with a consensual terminology that we can understand and share with each other. Now, we may not agree on the exact meaning of every single term, and that's and all that. That's fine. But whatever it is that we're trying to explain, we've got to be able to we've got to have enough of an understanding of each other and what it is that we're trying to do in order to provide a framework that will allow us to actually execute the actions we want to do to change whatever it is we're trying to change. Hmm.
At this point, I think it'd be good if you could actually talk about your definition of magic, because I think that would be helpful.
That in and of itself is a very interesting topic, because my definition of magic has shifted a lot. And in fact, in both multimedia magic and magical identity, I've devoted chapters to this concept of definition and what does that mean, and the idea of defining magic. Now, when I look at magic at this point, my definition of magic is that... Well, first of all, I'm going to define identity, and then I'm going to define magic, because this is they're going to play off of each other. So identity, I define identity as the agreement that a given person has with the universe, and that agreement is comprised, that agreement is partially defined by the consciousness of the person, but is also defined by cultural and physiological factors that the person may or may not be fully aware of, as well as by the person's internal beliefs and values, which, again, the person may or may not be fully aware of. Familial and ancestral values and beliefs, as well as ones that person has formed on his or her own. So there's this agreement with the universe. All right, that's identity. So now we look at magic. Well, magic is a technology. And by technology, I mean that it is a series of practices and techniques and other things that a person uses to interact with the universe and make changes to the universe by being able to bring possibility into reality. But at the same time, magic is also used to work with the identity of the person. And specifically, really what magic does is magic comes in and it aligns the person's identity with the desired possibility, the desired change, and basically makes sure that everything matches up. And then what it does is it creates that possibility and the person's in a new reality as a result. That's basically how I define magic at this point. That could change, and I guarantee it probably will change as time goes on, because it's changed from previous definitions I've had, and I always reserve the right to be able to change that, because the fact is I am a person I'm not going to be the same person that I am right now. It's 3:33 p.m. in Portland, Oregon, on this very sunny day of April, April 8th? Yeah, April 8th. I'm not going to be the same person I was tomorrow, or the next day, so my definition of magic will more than likely change, especially since I'm only 35 and have plenty of time left.
You're dynamic, you're not static.
That's right.
Okay, so I'm a person who's very interested in history and tradition and that type of mm-hmm. thing, and your work, I think, seems to me very evolutionary, and I'm curious where you see it in the context of any kind of magical tradition that you might see it in, associated with.
You know, when I look at my magical background, I have two distinct backgrounds that I draw on. One is Western and one is Eastern. The Western background is informed by William G. Gray and Franz Barden and some of those other lesser-known magicians that aren't Crowley and their work. And then the Eastern background is informed by my studies into Taoism and Dzogchen and Bon Tibetan shamanic practices, as well as Tantra. And most recently, what's been fascinating is I'm reading R.J. Stewart's books right now, and it's really fascinating to me because when I read his books, he actually was a student of William G. Gray's, and I can see similarities in how he approaches his magical work in the way similarities to how I approach things. I haven't met him yet. My wife is actually an associate of his, so at some point, hopefully, I'll get to meet him. But it's very interesting to me just to see those parallels, because he talks about process a fair amount in his books, and he has a very methodical way of describing how he works with things, and I see that actually in my own writing, and some of that definitely comes from Gray. So in the context of magical traditions, there's that, but then I'm going to throw in a couple of other contexts out there that I have to include because they necessarily inform my magical work. My academic background, I have a bachelor's and master's in English, and then I went partway through a PhD in literacy, rhetoric, and social practice, which basically was a combination of English and social sciences. And that academic background, the interest in definitions, for example, and in terms, definitely has impacted my approach to magic. And then, of course, there's my ongoing interest in neuroscience and biology, as well as semiotics and other disciplines, and all of that shapes my approach to magic, you know, cultural studies and all that. But in the context of the magical work, I would have to say that I do see that there is a there's kind of a melding of those two different backgrounds, because the Eastern approach is very much about doing internal work, at least for me it is, about doing that internal work and exploring the internal aspects of a person and you know, developing the golden embryo in Taoism. And there is mixed, you know, some interest in psychology and coaching practices, because I'm actually a business/life coach as well in my day job. But then in the Western side of things, there is this interest in the actual magical rituals and in the execution of those and the process. And again, that comes in from Gray. So there's definitely a background there, but at the same time, there's also very much a departure, because I am multidisciplinarian, and I haven't just stuck with magic. I've said, well, I'm going to take all these other interests and fit them all in there and see how they affect my magical work. So it's very much a multidisciplinary approach, and I think that is different from a lot of the work that I see out there. And I don't think it's a I think the work I see out there, there's some really excellent work. For example, I'm actually taking the strategic sorcery course by Jason Miller right now, and it's good work. It's very interesting, but I would have to say that I'm very different. That there's a element of traditionalism in his work that I don't see in mine, and it's not a criticism of him, because it very clearly works well for how he approaches things. But it's a recognition that for me, that while I have that background and that it definitely informs how I approach magic, I've gotten rid of pretty much the majority of traditional elements in how I work with magic and in how I approach it. And I think that's just a result of my varied interests, as well as my desire to evolve magic, because that's always been one of my interests, is, well, where can I take this next? Mm-hmm. Where can I go? It's, you know, I'd have to say, I would say of Jason that what he does really well is he teaches people how to go out there and get these results and take all these different aspects of magic and apply them. And he's like, he's basically kicks people off their butt and gets them moving and doing something different. And I would say that I do that in my own way, but it's without some of the things that he draws on. And again, but it's also with an idea that really, for me, I'm all about, where can we go? I'm going to experiment. I'm going to try all of these things out and bring it back and share it with people. I'm kind of like the shaman that goes out there into the wild and communes with the spirits and everything else, and then comes back to the tribe and says, here's the information I've gotten from these spirits. This is where we need to go next. And then again, I go somewhere else and I do the same thing. You know, that's kind of the way that I look at it for myself.
Mm. Based on just my reading of your work, my impression is has always really been kind of cutting edge because it was so much different than any kind of traditional approach. I think people appreciate that.
From the looks of it, they do. I mean, I've my Facebook page for Magical Experiments, that's my thing on there, seems to have a number of people that are on there. So I really and I really appreciate that. I think it's nice to have so many people who are actually interested.
I think it's just cool because, like, you have people who are traditionalists and you have people who are more experimental and non-traditional, and the fact that, you know, both approaches can be effective, even for the same person, I think is pretty fascinating.
It definitely is, and it highlights the fact that magic is not a set in stone type of thing. It's something that is that can evolve and grow and change, but that there's also value in being able to go and look at how things have been done before and doing things in that particular way. I think for me, what's really encouraging is, and I have to say, is that the age of social media has brought me much closer to the people that like my work, and it's made me aware that there are a lot of people that actually like it, which has been kind of a pleasant surprise for me in a lot of ways, because there have been times where I've definitely felt like the lone voice in the wilderness. So it's kind of nice to see that that's not the case so much anymore, if ever.
There you go. It's a small world now, right?
It is. It's a much smaller world. It's a good thing.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about this idea of cultural identity that you bring up in the book and that you mentioned earlier, because I find this in particular is a really interesting point. And what I'm getting at here is that oftentimes, not always, but you mentioned it yourself with your own interest in Taoism, Dzogchen, Bon, Buddhism, that people often become interested in esoteric or mystical ideas and practices and traditions that are not of their own culture. They're foreign to them, and yet they're able to make that shift. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how that may or may not fit in with the context of your own work.
That's a really good question. And first of all, when I talk about cultural identity, I also want to touch on family identity. You know, family identity is not necessarily cultural identity, although it's certainly informed by it, but just the impact that a family can have on your identity, the various experiences, the way it shapes your life, it can create some very interesting needs for people. And I think that a lot of those needs have definitely shaped people's interest in other cultures, because sometimes what we're really looking for is healing from things that have occurred to us. Things that have shaped our lives, and we can't necessarily find it in our culture because it's not there. So where do we go? We go to another culture to find it. When I talk about cultural identity, you know, I'd have to say that, like, for example, we have, you know, this identity in the U.S., this American culture, and it very much shapes our lives. And you can be part of different subcultures. For example, you and I were part of the occult subculture with its various dysfunctions and its functions and all those other different things and its various issues. Then you've got the goth subculture, which has its a very particular behavior and all that. But the one thing that the goths and the occultists share in common, besides maybe an interest in dark clothing, is, you know, they're also, at least in this country, what they have in common is that they're Americans. Now, obviously, if they're over in England or something else, then they don't have that same cultural. There's a related cultural history there, but it's not quite the same. There's differences there. And so when I explore this concept of cultural identity, I explore it really in the sense of, well, how does being a member of this particular type of culture affect us? And it's an important question because, and I tie it to nations because I think that a nation in and of itself has its own culture. For example, if I were to go over to Canada, there's a different culture there. It's not quite the same. It doesn't matter that Canadians are on the same continent. That's not what defines a culture. There are values. There are social behaviors, things like that. Now, it may not be radically different, but there are going to be differences there. And in some ways we see that in the debates and discussions that are present within a given country and what the people are talking about. So for us right now, for example, there's a lot of debate about Obama's healthcare plan and whether or not the justices can strike it down. And I was reading an article recently where in Europe they're like, what? Why would they even want to strike it down? Well, in Europe, that's part of their culture. They have this universal healthcare system that they're aware of. It's something that is part of their cult. It's part of their culture. It's something that they get on a level that we don't necessarily have. Whereas over here, it's a bit different. And so it's because of these cultural influences. So now let's look at these other cultures. Well, so why are we drawn to other cultures? I can't speak for anyone else, and I'm not going to here, but I'm going to tell you why I've been drawn to it. And I already mentioned one of the reasons. One of them is healing. You know, finding answers to questions, exploring things. For myself, what I found so fascinating about Taoism and Dzogchen and the various other practices is a way to get to do internal work, to really work with my connection not only to myself but to the world around me, to others, a way to really understand and situate myself that I don't feel is really present. Now, I would argue at the same time that the access that I have to those other cultures is not necessarily going to provide me an entirely accurate picture. I mean, I've read books on it. Maybe I've even gone and visited a Shinto shrine or a Zen temple or something like that, but over here in the stateside. But really, my perception of those cultures is mediated by my cultural identity here and the values and beliefs and inform that. And I say that because I think it's very important to acknowledge it. That unless like I was to go over, for example, and live in India or Tibet or one of those other places and actually experience the culture firsthand, I'm not going to – my experience of that culture is at best a secondhand experience. And even if I were to go over there, there are things I'm not going to necessarily get just because, again, I'm mediating it from my experience as an American. But with all that said, these various cultural interests – it's really a way to kind of explore this identity of our that we have. It's really a way to explore, well, if I can get this other perspective, and yes, it's mediated, but still it's a different perspective than what I've had, how will it inform my life and how I do things? How can I use it for healing? How can I use it to understand other people? How can I use it to experience a different perspective on reality? All these other things how do I go about manifesting results differently as a result of studying Taoism? How does it affect that? Any of these other various reasons that we come up with for it. What fascinates me the most is that we are seeing increasingly a kind of global metaculture. Some of that we see with the economy, some of it what we see is cultural influences coming over and having an impact on different cultures. So, for example, there's this fascination with anime and manga right now. Now, does anime and manga really represent Japanese culture? It represents a perspective on Japanese culture. It's not, but and realistically, the people that get into it don't necessarily come away with a fully developed understanding. The only way they're going to even be able to really get that is if they go and live there for a while and actually experience what it's like. And even then, they're still probably going to get a filtered perspective because they're not necessarily part of the culture so much as they're observers or visitors visiting that culture. But it's just fascinating to me to see how much culture shapes our outlook on life and how these various cultures that we partake of or interact with, how they in turn shape our sense of identity. So for me, those studies have definitely given me some different perspectives, a way of looking at things. It's also made me aware of how limited in some ways my cultural background is by virtue of what it is. And I think that's something that anybody who goes outside of their own culture realizes on some level or another when they start to go out there, is they realize what I think of or what I'm aware of is very different from this culture and its perspectives, and it makes you either decide you're going to grow or turtle up. Either way, you do one or the other.
Would you mind spending a few minutes talking about space-time magic as described in Magical Identity and the Memory Box?
Sure. In Magical Identity, I ended up writing three chapters on it. One chapter was just devoted to space. One chapter was devoted to time, and then the last chapter was devoted, actually it was four chapters, but the third chapter was devoted to my model of space and time magic, and then the fourth chapter was space-time tarot work, using two different tarot decks together for space-time work and other fun stuff. Anyway, when I wrote space-time, the original book, Space-Time Magic, I had a very... Yeah, you know, it was kind of my explorations of space and time and all that, and there was some, you know, discussion about physics and things like that. And then in Magical Identity, I shifted away from a lot of that, and instead what I did is I focused on space in terms of both the physical space around you and the physical space of your body, and movement as well. What the role of movement is within space. And I find that really interesting because it actually it's really an exploration of how we navigate space and how we conceptually define space. There's a really interesting writer, and it's in the biography, Edward T. Hall. He was an anthropologist who devoted an extensive amount of time to space and time and exploring them from cultural perspectives. And time, again, really kind of exploring time both in terms of linear and nonlinear perspectives from an anthropological perspective. Approach. You know, for example, we live in a monochronic time culture. What does that mean? Is that it means that we're very linear in our approach to time. So, for example, you and I set the time for us to talk at 3 p.m. my time and at 6 p.m. your time. And we got on there and we started, and it was very much a defined thing of this event is going to occur at this time, and then the next event will occur at this time, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got polychronic time cultures, and these are cultures where time's approached a bit more nonlinearly. And so an example that Edward Hall used was going in and visiting a person for an appointment in Mexico, and there were all these other people there, and everybody was kind of there to see this person at the same time, and business went on. It seemed like a much more chaotic environment, but actually it was something that worked really well because of their approach to time. So exploring the differences of that. Now, the Memory Box is this tool I came up with years ago, and it's a wooden box, and on the inside there's the silver paint, and it's paint for it's in the shape of the Kairos, this thing that Brian Shaughnessy came up with, this particular symbol. So it's painted on the inside of the box, and the Memory Box is actually this tool that I use to surf the web of space and time. I use the word surf kind of like internet, but it's a bit different than that. And for my model, there's this really this sense of I'm working with this entity I call the Spider Queen of Time, and I encountered this entity as a result of reading Auriel Bascule Defenestrate, try and say his name three times fast. His book, A Brief History of Time, where he talks quite a bit about spiders and time. And when I read the book and I kind of did some of the workings out of it, I had this encounter with this entity called the Spider Queen of Time, and she's at the center of this web weaving this time. And my approach to space-time magic then is shaped by this. I use this memory box. I don't even always use it anymore, but it was a useful tool at the time to access this space-time web. And the strand, what it represents is at a given intersection of strands, you have nodules of space. And the nodules of space represent people, places, things, events, basically nouns. If we want to use the English language, they represent nouns. And then the strands between those nodes represent, between the nodes where they connect, represent the flow of time going through and possibilities that can go and affect that space. And the idea really is that a person who is working with their own personal web of space, their own web of space and time, what they're really doing is they recognize that they inhabit a given space at any time, and that the other spaces are reached through the flow of time, and that time represents not just a straightforward progression, but really access to different possibilities. And so what we end up doing is we grab a hold of that of a particular possibility and use that to shift ourselves to another space that represents the actualization or realization of that possibility, basically a new reality. And consequently, the web itself shifts around us because you're always at the center of the web, because and so all the various spaces and things like that around you are representative of, as I said, the nouns in your life, the people, places, things, the desired results, what have you. But when you shift from the possibility that you were in, the reality that you were in, to a new reality, you kind of move the web as well as a result. Now that in and of itself could just be an affectation on my part, and I accept that if it is. But that's kind of my model of space and time, and a brief synopsis of what I talk about in the book along those lines.
You mentioned Oriole Defenestrate Bascule. Or...
Bascule Defenestrate. It's a convoluted name, but yeah.
Forgive me if I'm screwing that up.
No, don't worry about it. He'll have to forgive us. Let's just hope he does.
But he's a master of words, and wordplay is from my recollection. But this idea of the spider, the spider web, of using this as a model for time travel or manipulation of space-time or even some sort of divination, I've seen this idea in several places. So it's not foreign to me. It's just it's really interesting. And I assume, having never actually done it myself, that it's effective because so many people seem to really gravitate to this model, or it's simply the one that's been propagated, you know, not necessarily by humanity, but, you know, more by nature, say.
I think there's some truth to that. I also think that as we, as society, as our understanding of time and space evolves, that and just kind of shifts, that this naturally ends up being a topic of more and more interest to people, and I think a way for them to navigate their lives and understand their lives. So that makes sense to me.
I want to give you an opportunity to address the listeners if you had any thoughts about the book. I think there's probably a ton of things we didn't even cover, but I want to give you just a chance to, you know, talk about whatever's on your mind.
Whatever's on my mind is if you get a chance, check out the book, so to speak. But really, no, what's on my mind at this point is I'm actually working on my first correspondence course. Which I'll be announcing hopefully within the next week or two. We've gotten forums. We almost have the forums set up on my website. It's going to be a course called The Process of Magic, really exploring magic as a process and exploring how to deconstruct and take apart a given magical technique and then turn it into something that works for you on a personalized level. So that's on my mind. I'm also working on a book on wealth magic as well. So that's kind of on my mind. I'm actually happy to say that magical identity really isn't on my mind that much anymore, other than doing the interviews right now and doing some marketing for it, because, you know, it's been on my mind for the last 5 years, and it feels good to finally be able to say, you know, it's done. It's put to bed. But I guess what I would say out there is, you know, is that I hope that people will, to the listeners, I hope that all of you will, you know, check it out and, you know, play around with the ideas and see what you think. And of course, you're more than welcome to interact with me or contact me if you check out my site at magicalexperiments.com. And as I said, there will be forums up there soon. So if you have questions, you'll be able to get on there and ask those. And that's pretty much what I have to say about that.
Thank you so much, Taylor Elwood. Again, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope you'll stay with us for the next segment.
Definitely. Thank you.
Excellent.
For the Occult of Personality membership section, Taylor Elwood describes two traditional Eastern breathing exercises and then guides a space-time meditation that is simply phenomenal. In addition, Taylor has graciously provided the first chapter of Magical Identity. Be sure to check out that excellent recording and book excerpt.